if you do listen to Theology Live, you know, like, all he has are, like, brilliant, credentialed guests. And I think I'm the first hack in the history of the program. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't a joke.
Last month, I accepted a call to be a canon at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral in Denver, Colorado, where I will begin working in mid-October. Thankfully, Theology Live in our parish church will continue just without me. With that being said, when I invited Mike McHarg to join us as the first guest of Season 3 of Theology Live, I had no idea that this would be my final episode as host of the podcast. Tonight, Mike will help us probe the complex dimensions of mystery, science, and Christian faith. Welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Today's guest is Mike McHarg, host of the Liturgist podcast, Ask Science Mike, and author of Finding God in the Waves. I am the Reverend Broderick Greer, Associate Rector of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. So, Mike, thank you for being with us tonight.
Wow. Yeah, I can't believe it. I don't want to ruin the vibe. It is super trippy for me to hear you do the intro in person. Because I'm like usually on an airplane listening to that. It's like, oh my gosh, he's right there.
So this is confirmation that two people listen to our podcast, my mother and Mike McHarg. Hello, Mom. So, Mike, tell us who you are and what life looks like for you right now.
Okay, wow. I am Mike McHarg. The internet calls me Science Mike, which is ridiculous because I'm not a scientist. I'm a college dropout who worked in advertising, and the Science Mike thing was literally a joke at a party where people had too many drinks that became my name in public. It's super weird. This season of my life has led to a lot of introspection. I have a lot of curiosity about why anyone has interest in what I say. And so I think that's solidarity. I grew up really conservative evangelical, which no one in this room can relate to. And then I stopped being that. I became an atheist to the universal acclaim and acceptance of my family and friends back home. And when the torches and pitchforks stopped, I had to figure out what faith meant to me as a person whose primary lens for understanding the world is kind of an atheistic materialism. But I had this one time, I was on the beach and I saw a bright light and felt the warmth of God's love, and even heard what I thought was Jesus talking to me, oddly enough, in English. And
which we can confirm is not Jesus's first language.
Yes, clearly. So that experience moved me so much, I asked my neurologist for a brain scan because I thought I had brain cancer, and I didn't have brain cancer, so I started trying to probe what is God. And I went through a period where I called theology fan fiction because that was like people talking about a made-up thing they care a lot about. So to me, like writing a theological treatise was like writing Harry Potter fan fiction. So instead, I went to the more serious, and I can't see air quotes, serious discipline of physics to try to understand like where did we all come from. And then I got really into brain science to understand how we ascribe divine will or agency or action or relationship to the rules of reality. So I'm always would tell people, I'm not evangelical, but let me tell you the good news of neurotheology. So you can't leave your roots, ultimately. So my life is literally going all over the world to talk to people about their doubts and hopes and fears about that which we call God as a fellow non-expert.
So you have called yourself a Christian turned atheist, turned follower of Jesus. And I know that this can be considered a little nitpicky, but are you making it? And I know that this isn't what this is about, but I hear people say stuff like this a lot. Do you make a distinction between Christian and follower of Jesus? Because I know, and that's popular right now. And I guess I get a little offended because I'm like, I'm a Christian, and Christian means follower of Jesus. Like, those aren't two different things. So are you making that distinction or not?
I've kind of come full circle, and I call myself a Christian again. So we'll take a little mental time capsule to when I refuse to use that word. And the reason I refuse to use the word Christian is I associated the movement that started as people following Jesus that morphed into a primarily social political institution as something that hurt people. And so when someone said, are you a Christian? If that person was a racial minority or gay or disabled or in some other way marginalized, I didn't want my answer to immediately, yes, I'm comfortably your oppressor. So I went through this like period of reflection on what this word really means and whether it's appropriate to use. And frankly, it's only by discovering the work, which is completely new to me as a former Southern Baptist, this broad scholarship of theologians of color, queer theologians, people from different perspectives, that I felt comfortable using the term again. Because if marginalized people can redeem this term, then who am I to continue to critique it from the outside?
Interesting.
So I actually changed my bio. I took that out everywhere I used to use it. And what drew me again to Jesus, having all these doubts about a resurrection and supernatural anything, was this voice calling out against an empire that broke backs and put people down. And that's what like drew me to it again. And the faith of my youth was the silent moral majority. And it just didn't seem to have any relationship to Jesus at all. But now I just say yes. And the reason I say yes is I'm trying desperately to structure my life in a way that it's not that I wear a safety pin. It's like every action I make, I hope, illustrates to people at different intersections of identity that I am a person who's not about being part of an empire that oppresses them, but doing the work of Jesus and helping tear it down.
And this is not a question I even have on here. I mean, it seems that in your work, and I'm mainly familiar with your work through Twitter, which is where I live, that's my address, you have this increasing focus on racial justice. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey in that direction?
Yeah, I think everybody should take at least one life stroll through existential nihilism. So, like, at least for a while, you should just believe nothing. And you should believe that absolutely every attempt for humans to justify knowledge about the world is folly and ridiculous and not possible. Because it projects you to a posture, and I mean this sincerely, of profound humility about anything you think you know, if you've been fundamentally wrong twice in a row about the nature of reality. And so this nihilistic core in my heart led me to interrogate the theological framework and story I was handed as I grew up, with some pretty surprising results. You know, I had a really close friend in high school who was gay, and shortly after we graduated, like, he asked me, like, what he should do it to be reconciled with God. Like, we'd built up enough relational credibility, he would ask me, an evangelical, that question. And I said, you should turn away from your sin. So And we're still friends, which is a miracle. But one of the first things that, as I became an atheist, I realized I couldn't justify anymore was opposition to same-sex marriage. There's no scientific secular ground for such a position. Well, so when you've lost what is the most important belief in your life, a belief that God exists and loves you, you've developed a surprisingly valuable new tool, and that is to interrogate ideas that you hold deeply, and in fact, to accept their ideas you hold unconsciously. And this means, when in the first time with discussions with friends of mine who are black, pervasive white supremacy in our culture, I now had a nihilist tool set to examine my initial fragile response to the idea and go, wait a second, why is my amygdala pumping stress hormones? I'm not physically in danger. And this led me almost take a distance from the initial reflex of, no, we're all equal. America's a land of equality. The conditioning we've all been handed as children. And
can that also be manifested as this hashtag All Lives Matter?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If anyone's heard of that before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I get All Lives Matter because before it was a hashtag, that would have just been a reflexive response from me. Nobody understands, I don't think anybody understands white supremacy as well as I do experientially. So my core of nihilism let me, instead of just reacting unconsciously and emotionally to critiques of a white supremacist culture, to say, no, let me listen, let me understand, let me look into the scholarship. And the more I dug into it, the more it became to me the most pressing issue in human society. The root from which everything else we're talking about, the way our economy exploits the natural world, the way we deal with climate change, the way we deal with issues of equality, it all comes back to the fact that the most powerful culture in the world was founded by literally stealing land from indigenous people and then extracting wealth by exploiting labor from slaves, the largest forced migration in human history. And when I first started talking about race and racism in my work, a pretty significant progressivist part of my audience was like, you've got to stop talking about this stuff. You'll lose all credibility. The important thing is you help people get close to Jesus again. And of course, by that they mean get close to white Jesus again, get close to capitalist Jesus again, get close to a Jesus that encourages the empire of Christianity that made me call myself a Jesus follower. And so I've actually shifted. I used to say that I talked about the intersection of science and faith, and now I say I sit at the intersection of science and faith and social justice, which is a delicate line to walk as a white person. So I'm always trying to figure out, how do I amplify those voices that matter most in the conversation? And what I've learned is, in the same way I'm a non-expert who helps people get excited about science just because I love it so much, can I help white people not be afraid of their own emotional reactions by saying, no, I have those reactions too. Now, can you listen to this person and not ask them to unpack your feelings for you? Literally just listen to them. If you need to unpack your feelings, I'll unpack your feelings with you. Okay? We'll unpack feelings together, and then you and I'll give you things to Google. You can Google, you can read these books, and you cannot ask people of color to do the emotional labor that comes from your unconscious actions oppressing their lives.
I did not tell Mike to say any of this.
But that, it's like, what is the way of Christ? If I believe in Jesus, if I believe that this story of this man matters, that means I'm trying to understand an offshoot of the Jewish faith from the perspective of a Roman. And I have to place myself in that relationship to the story, that to some degree, I am an outsider and I'm a part of the oppressive system. But that's the great part of the Bible story, as I've seen it, as I've read it. They made room for the Romans. But with a caveat. I think that's what it means to take up your cross, right? I can't say I want it both ways. I want to be at the table of fellowship, and I want to maintain a lofty position in society where I get paid more for less work. And I want good schools, and I want total equality for everybody as long as it doesn't cost me anything. That's not the way of the cross.
I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with podcast host and author Mike McHarg. We're discussing mystery, science, Christian faith, and social justice. A friend of mine, Winnie Varghese, who's a priest in New York, about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I heard her talk to a group of LGBTQ Episcopalians, and she said, when Jesus says to take up your cross, he's understanding that a cross is never something that God gives you, it's something that the world gives you, which was deeply illuminating for me, because, you know, LGBT Christians, people of color, women, so many people who live at those various intersections of oppression often can feel like, you know, those crosses are things that they are supposed to, you know, that God has given them. This is your cross to bear. I mean, that's like an actual phrase people say in real life, like, this is your cross to bear. I don't even know where I was going with that, but I just felt like I should say that because you said that.
Yeah, that's an important distinction.
And since you went in this direction, let's talk about this. I've been reading a great book by Willie Jennings. I'm a very slow reader, so I've been reading it for like 7 months, called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. And he makes this argument that basically Christianity in the West, at least, is so deeply entrenched in white supremacy and white identity, in the genocide of indigenous people, in the enslavement of people of African descent, sexism. You know, there are scholars who call this white, cisgender, heterosexual, patriarchal capitalism. And there are forms of theology that really kind of have that assumption as well about the world. And he makes the argument that really the extraction of Jesus from his Jewish identity, the extraction of anything that was earthy, anything that was material, anything that had to do with humanity from Christianity is what has made Christianity kind of this oppressive force that it is. Can you speak to that at all? Am I kind of too far left field? It sounds like that might be connected to kind of your own journey and realization.
Yeah, so that was, I think, actually maps pretty well to how we would understand like some of the neurological differences between Western Christians and other people of faith across the world. The dramatically disembodied nature of Western Christianity means that literally when you brain scan Western Christians and ask them to think of God, like their prefrontal cortex and analytical capacity start up, right? That's where you see all this activity. And if you talk to like a nun who meditates a lot, or a Pentecostal who speaks in tongues, you notice there's this fascination in Western Christianity with literally anything that reminds us we have a physical body, because our entire structure is designed to denying it or calling it evil, right? Like, oh, you had a feeling in your body? That's the devil, right? Like, you've got to just live. You just got to know the right ideas. You got to believe the right things, because if you believe the right things, if you literally kill someone, that's okay. God will forgive you as long as you've got the right ideas. And it shows up in brain scans. We become a prefrontal cortex faith. And that's a very shallow, that's like the most recent bolted on by evolution thing in our skull. We don't live in our prefrontal cortex. In fact, brain scientists will often call that your brain's CEO, or the brain's executive, but we're learning that might not be true. Your prefrontal cortex is actually like your brain's narrator. It just explains what's happening and takes credit for it. So if people have like brain damage that affects their memory and they, you know, knock over a can of soup in the kitchen and then a moment later see it and don't remember doing it, they'll make a rational explanation for why they did it on purpose, because it's just your narrator. And an embodied faith lives more in the experiential parts of the brain, down toward the limbic system. It involves more activity in the basal ganglia, in the ventral stratum. By the way, it's more sustainable because it feels good. And if you've grown up in an evangelical tradition, like you've been told like fact before feeling, right? By the way, they didn't give you like an epistemology to determine what is fact other than the Bible, just the Bible. And this is like a brilliant cognitive system because you've been taught to mistrust your intuitive reaction to other people, like your empathy. You've been taught that God hates sin, and you've been taught there's an authority that is to describe what sin is. And then you have this intermarriage in the West, in the Southeast especially, between theology and conservative politics. And so lazy people become sinful. And then the narrative you hear, because your church has one token black family, if that, is that all those people of color are lazy, and that's why they don't have money. And so you're like, the unrighteous are being punished. That's what I mean. It's all the same ball of spaghetti. There's no scientific or neurological ability to divide a disembodied idea-only Christianity from people being colorblind, complicit participants in a system of oppression, right? And that lets you, the brilliance here is you can hold your nose and you can say, I can't believe those people hold Confederate flags and say the N-word. What racists? You know what I mean? All I do is oppose justice reform and police reform, like any reasonable person. It sets, right, like, oh. So it sets this ridiculous standard wherein you can participate in terrible systems and feel justified in your faith and therefore achieve one of the primary needs cognitive psychologists say that human beings have, and that is to feel like you are a good person. It lets you be part of the destruction of the world and the oppression of people, all the while getting to feel like you are a good person.
Well, in Finding God in the Waves, you write, the way I see God is not an attempt to take the mystical out of reality. It's a way to incorporate the miracle and mystery of the life we can see, measure, observe, and test every day. Can you say more about metaphors for God that you find to be most helpful and imaginative?
Ooh, that is a tough question. I've been trying through my meditative practice to let go of every metaphor I have.
Interesting.
So I guess the closest I could get, the source and the grounding of all is a metaphor I love for God.
That is an Anglican idea.
No. Believe me, I have raided the Anglican
pantry. We came up with that.
yeah. And in like a conscious pushback on my unconscious tendency to always assign the pronoun him to God, if I think of God in a personal manner, I try to think of God as mother as much as I possibly can as a matter of brain training.
I know someone who often tweets that, actually it's me, I'm gonna say it. I did not want to take credit for this, but basically when we reduce God to just being a cisgender man, we have shafted the incarnation.
It's true.
I think so. I think especially when the Hebrew Bible and even the New Testament are so rich with metaphors of God as a midwife, of God as a mother. I mean, Jesus says he's a friend. I mean, there are all of these various ways of referring to God. And when we idolize one way, one metaphor, I mean, because, you know, I'm sure you've run into this, where you say, well, you know, I don't think that God is a man or male. And people will say, well, the Lord's Prayer says our Father, you know, as if that's like the best argument ever. And you think about, you know, a kind of a first century Jewish Aramaic understanding of what the word father meant of, I don't know, I mean, they had a different sense of reproduction. And so basically they understood father the way we understand father and mother together. Like, if God said, let us make them in our image, that means within God is this expansive definition of gender. I mean, infinite.
Yes. Yes.
Infinite.
And I'd say emphasis on infinite, too. If I try to, like, think of the best physical metaphor I can get to for God, I always go to the singularity at the beginning of the Big Bang. This infinite compression with the potential to produce all. And it definitely does not have a penis. And you know what I mean? It doesn't have a Y chromosome, beard, any of the fatherly traits we want to use are not in the singularity. There's just this profound potential that to me, even to say male and female is not far enough.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To say human only is not far enough. To say, you know what I mean? So you do know what I mean. I stole it from you. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. I've been trying to let go of metaphors for God. I'm comfortable sitting in God's presence. I'm comfortable knowing and loving God. I become increasingly more suspicious of any metaphor I try to use to describe God.
Mm. Well...
checkmate, atheists.
This podcast has been, and don't tell anyone I said this, the crowning joy of my priesthood so far. To sit down with theological and cultural luminaries over food and drink, gathered with friends and parishioners from across our city, has enlivened me in ways I cannot describe. Over 23 episodes, we've discussed everything from eschatology to reproductive justice to womanism to Lent to religious extremism to vulnerability. And my, how our guests have time and again impressed me with their willingness to speak of themselves, of God, in such gracious and creative ways. And my, how God has shown up in our midst, not necessarily as a roll of thunder, but as the subtle nod of the head and the quiet conversation happening over in the corner. Every conversation has taught me that statements lead to static ways of being, and questions take us on quests. Quests like the one Mike is on. Quests like the ones all of us are on. Quests that deepen our sense that God can be known, but not fully explained or figured out. That we might only ever see through a glass dimly, if we can see at all. Thank you to our digital and in-person audiences for making my quest here worthwhile and full of joy. Because if theology, this God talk that we do, doesn't lead us to joy, it is not worthwhile at all. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to Mike McHarg, the staff here at Church Health, especially Ms. Lauren Hells, our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer, and our caterers, Mama Gaia. Join us on October 12, 2017, this same place, when Meredith Day, youth minister at Grace St. Luke's Church and teacher at Grace St. Luke's School, interviews Dr. Andre Johnson about what Christian theology has to say about the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events. If you have not already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform. Then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you all so much. This was great. Enjoy.